The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. As a student of philosophy at Haverford College in the 70s, Juan Williams learned how to ask the hard questions about the nature of reality and about the elusiveness of truth, skills of inquiry that served him well in his career as a journalist, author, and political analyst. Mr. Williams began his career in Philadelphia, cutting his teeth as a cub reporter for the Philadelphia Bulletin during the glory days of the Rizzo administration. He later worked at the Washington Post, where for 20 years he served as a congressional correspondent and a White House correspondent before moving on to CNN, where he hosted Crossfire, and not long after, he became a political analyst for Fox News. He is also the best-selling author of the seminal history of the civil rights movement, Eyes on the Prize, among other books, all of this before joining NPR. It's at this point where our presence this evening and Mr. Williams' story converge. It's a story he gives context to and uses as a springboard for an examination of how the nature of political discourse has changed, which he examines in his new book, Muzzled: The Assault on Honest Debate. Please welcome Juan Williams.
Andy, thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me to be here, not only in Philadelphia, which is a city I love, but here at the library. And I just love libraries. I can tell you as a child growing up in Brooklyn, New York, that the public library, for me, was a door to the world. It just opened so many windows for me. I remember it was there that I first met Pippi Longstockings, you know? It was there that I first encountered James T. Farrell's Stud Lonigan, and a kid growing up in gangland Chicago in the 30s. And, of course, there at the library that I first encountered Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, and the experience of young black people in America. So, to me, libraries are a very special place. I'm always amused when I come across this fact, which is told by people who write about libraries, that they not only convey great ideas and experiences, but that they're the keepers of power and legend and, of course, heroes. There are five characters that are known around the world, all come out of literature. Let's see if I can remember them. It's Superman, it's Tarzan, it's Robin Hood, Sherlock Holmes, and Mickey Mouse. And, of course, they're all here in the library somewhere, so I remember one great writer, Borges, once said that for him, heaven would be a great public library. And let me just add in there, my angels would be great librarians who help young kids discover books, discover new worlds, because I think truly, you know, you have to be in love with reading before you become a good writer. So you can't have writers without good readers, and that's all thanks to very good, caring librarians. This is an interesting moment to talk about stories and all the stories that are held here in this library, and the story that I have written, Muzzled: The Assault on Honest Debate, because the story I have just lived through, for me, is hard to believe. I never thought I'd be in a position to write a book about being called a bigot. To me, this is unbelievable. It would be like, wow, I don't think that's credible. How could I write that story? I mean, I've written books, as Andy was telling you, about the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. I wrote a biography of Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, the first African American to sit on the high court. I wrote a book about the black religious experience in the United States, This Far by Faith, a story about a book about the history of black colleges in America. I'll Find a Way or Make One. And, of course, my last book, was about Bill Cosby, another Philadelphia hero, Bill Cosby's epic struggle with trying to confront this issues of dysfunction inside the black community and then being chastised, being told that he wasn't a good brother for having said what he said. So all of these issues, it seemed to me, were of such centrality to the idea of race and the struggle for racial equality, and then to suddenly find myself in the position where I'm having to defend myself against charges of bigotry just seems so outrageous, so crazy to me. I mean, I wouldn't believe the story. I hope that you are more gullible than I am, because I'm not sure I'd buy the book. When I even was, you know, faced with this charge for the first time, and I said to the person who was firing me, I'd like to come in and talk to you about this. Have you really heard all that I said, the context? Do you understand the notion that this was a very vigorous debate taking place in the highly charged environment of cable TV? I was told, no, we don't. There's nothing you can say, nothing you can do that would change our minds. So in a sense, in essence, after having worked there 10 years, I was muzzled. I was just told, no, nothing you can say. Don't bother moving your lips. Don't say anything. You know, I was thinking about how to speak with you tonight, people who come to the library, people who love books, who love reading, and who I would bet love news and love radio and love National Public Radio. And I was thinking to myself, what I'd like to do, given this place, is engage you in an act of imagination. And the act of imagination is this. I would say to you, let's all imagine that you're listening to a talk radio broadcast. And I am going to be the host of this talk radio broadcast tonight. And so what I want you to do is imagine that as your host, I begin, welcome to the show. And I say, I'm Juan Williams. I'm your host for this hour. And today, our guest is Juan Williams. And we're going to take your calls about our topic, which is Mr. Williams firing from NPR and his new book, Muzzle, The Assault on Honest Debate. But first, let's ask Juan for an update about what's been going on. So Juan, what are you up to now? And I'd say, well, you know, I just had a book published last week, and I've been heartened by the reception, in fact, a little bit overwhelmed. I mean, I've been on Jon Stewart on Comedy Central. I've been on Brian Lamb on C-SPAN. I've been on Bill O'Reilly on Fox News. So everybody seems to relate to this topic in a way that makes it very clear to me very quickly that this topic is much bigger than my firing. I am, in fact, a little knocked out at how much resonance this seems to have for the American people, who feel that in so many conversations, in so many instances, they feel they can't say what's on their mind, that someone is going to call them a bigot, a racist, a crazy right-winger, a bleeding heart liberal, that they don't feel that they can calmly participate in honest debate and discussion of key issues of our day. Now I'm back to playing host. And I'd say, Juan, well, remind us, before we get into all the theory here, how did this start? How did this get going? And I'd say, well, it feels to me like I've told this story 1,000 times, but if anybody has been hiding under a rock, Bill O'Reilly is a primetime cable host, and Bill O'Reilly had been on The View, and conservative, dominant, male Bill O'Reilly had said that on 9/11, anniversary of which is coming up next month, 10th anniversary, O'Reilly said on 9/11, Muslims killed us. Muslims attacked us. And that prompted Whoopi Goldberg and Joy Behar to walk off the set at that moment until O'Reilly apologized by saying he meant to say radical Muslim extremist. Then the ladies came back on, but it was a very tense little set. And, of course, in America's celebrity media culture, it was in the papers the next day as the dominant male O'Reilly, such a conservative, taking on the liberal ladies of The View and the ladies walking off. So it became a little bit of a celebrated instance. The next time O'Reilly had his own show on Fox News, I was his lead guest. And in a moment of vulnerability, he surprised me by saying, "Tell me where I was wrong in saying Muslims killed us on 9/11. And I said, "Well, Bill, I'm not going to play politically correct games with you. Technically, you're right. The people who flew the airplanes into the buildings said that they were acting in the spirit of what they called a jihad, and they cited their Islamic faith as the basis, the justification for these attacks on the United States." And I said, in fact, just a week before, the Times Square bomber had said in court that what America has experienced so far is just the first drop of blood in a war that Muslims are waging against the United States. And then I famously said, and in all honesty, I've got to tell you that when I'm in an airport getting on a plane, if I see people who are dressed in Muslim garb, to my mind, first and foremost, identifying themselves as Muslim, I get nervous. It makes me uncomfortable. Now let me go back to being the host. And I'd say, "Well, wait a second, Juan. The minute you said that, the minute the words came out of your mouth, did you realize you had offended people and that you risked being called a bigot?" And I'd say, hold on, wait a minute, let me finish my story. The fact is that I never had any clue, I never had any, you know, whack yourself in the head moment in the shower subsequently where I said, "Oh, I should have said that differently." To the contrary, at that moment, on that show, in the midst of that highly charged debate environment on cable TV, I went on to say, "Timothy McVeigh is a Christian, and he bombed the Oklahoma City building, the Murrow building in Oklahoma City." I went on to say that the man who committed the Atlanta Olympic bombing was a Christian, and that the people from the Westboro Baptist Church who engage in those offensive rants at military funerals are Christians, but we don't draw conclusions about Christians on the basis of their behavior, and we shouldn't do that about Muslims. And that America is a country that celebrates religious liberty, and we engage in acts of tolerance, and yes, there is a link, an inextricable link, between radical Islam and terrorism, but that America has to protect its liberties even as we fight against this threat. I said this all at the time. And then let me go back to being the host, and the host would say, "But did you realize that you had opened yourself to these charges?" And I would say, "No, I'm keep telling you, not to this moment. In fact, when I was being fired, the woman who called up to fire me 2 days later said to me, 'What did you mean?' And I said, 'I meant what I said.' And she said, 'Are you ready to apologize?' And I said, 'Apologize for what?' At which point then she indicated to me that she considered what I had said to be bigotry, that there were people who worked at NPR who dressed in Muslim garb and who would be uncomfortable, and that I had offended them, that I had stirred this pot. And I said to her, 'What are you talking about? I never for any moment endorsed any kind of discrimination. I never for a moment said that we should in fact have policies that would keep anybody off a plane or out of a job.' That's when I said to her, 'You know, can I come in and talk to you about this? Can we have a conversation about it?' And was told there was nothing I could say and nothing I could do." Back to being the host. Well, Juan, what happened then? what happened after you left that show that night? And I'd say, well, you know, I went home, I had dinner, nothing big, watched the ball game, flew off to Chicago the next day to give a talk. And in fact, when I got to the talk, there were people there who were complimenting me on standing up to O'Reilly, on saying to O'Reilly, hey, you know what, you have to be careful how you speak about the fact that we are fighting against terrorism, because you don't want to encourage people like that pastor in Florida who wanted to burn the Quran, or the person who was threatening and in fact did cut a cab driver's throat in New York because he thought he was a Muslim. We don't want to encourage that, to which O'Reilly said he was sick and tired of being careful in addressing what is clearly evidence of the link between Islam, radical Islam, and terrorism. And people at the speech are saying to me, that was a great conversation, an important conversation for us all to have right now in this country at this moment. And then on the way back from the speech that night in Chicago, I was in O'Hare Airport, starving, standing in a line, trying to get a slice of pizza before the plane left. And a man comes up to me and he says, are you Juan Williams? I said, yes. He said, well, I saw you on TV last night and I just want to thank you, because I'm Muslim, I'm a businessman here, I live in suburban Chicago, and just the other day I was in my den, and my little boy came in, my 12-year-old, and he saw me put a letter with Arabic writing into a paper shredder. And he said to me, Dad, are you doing that because you don't want the neighbors to know that we're Muslims? And the father was taken aback by this and said to the young boy, no, not at all, but it has Allah's name on the envelope, and you don't want to just throw that in with the trash. You want to dispose of it appropriately. And then engaged his son in a conversation about why the boy would think it was a shameful thing to be a Muslim. And he said to me that this to him was a wake-up call, that he couldn't just go about being a successful businessman in suburban Chicago, but that he had to get more involved in the politics of the Muslim community, and changing the image of the Muslim community and fighting against stereotypes in the Muslim community, if it was already having an impact on his son that he had not realized until that moment in his home office. Now I'm back to being the host. And I'd say, well, when did you get fired? How long after the show was it that you got fired? I said, well, so I was in Chicago that Tuesday. The next day I was in New York. And as I was going into the city, I got a phone call from a woman who runs an advocacy group in Washington. She said, I wanted to see how you were bearing up under all the calls for you to be fired. And I said, what calls for me to be fired? And she said, oh, the office has just been flooded with emails from various groups led by the Council on American-Islamic Relations saying that you're a bigot and you should be thrown out of NPR. I said, look, don't worry about it. You wouldn't believe the things people say about me. I hear it from all sides. It's just part of the job of being a news analyst. Nobody likes everything I said. Some people like it. Some people don't like it. Black, white, Israeli, Palestinian. My goodness, you know, it goes on any side of any issue. So don't worry about it. I just take that stuff like, you know, water over the falls or whatever, under the bridge. And she said, oh, okay. And I went off, and I started doing my work in New York. And I was pretty much through my day and hungry again. You can tell I like to eat. And so it was about 5 o'clock, going on 6 o'clock at night. I noticed there was a message waiting on my cell phone, so I got it. And sure enough, it was my boss in Washington at NPR. And I returned the call. And that's when I was told that my contract was being terminated and that I had violated the journalistic standards of NPR by making this statement. That's when I was fired. Back to being the host. So what did you do? What was your immediate reaction? I really don't know. I think I was sort of in shock because I went off. I tried to call my wife. I couldn't reach her. And ended up eating some Chinese food, wandered around a little bit, went back to the studios. At night, I was supposed to be on Sean Hannity's show. engaged in my usual shouting match with Sean Hannity. And then afterwards, as I'm walking off the set, Sean Hannity says to me, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "What do you mean by that?" Thinking he was still in attack mode. And he says, no, you all right? And I said, "No, I'm not all right, actually. You know, I'm glad you asked because I just got fired." To which he responded, "Fired from what?" And I said, "Well, fired, not fired here, thank God, but fired from NPR. And he then engaged me in a conversation about exactly what was the basis for the firing, what was I told. And I realized I hadn't spoken to anybody. And it was like, you know, so much emotion and power emerging in that moment, and then phone calls being made. By this time, it's 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and people being awakened, and I was told not to say another word. I should go see the boss in the morning and all that. Now I'm back to being the radio talk show host. So what have you taken away from this? What have you learned? Well, I think what I've learned is that I was initially fearing for my career, thinking, oh my gosh, you know, NPR is such a loved brand. They've got microphones in every town, and they're going to paint me in the most negative light. They're going to control the narrative of how this takes place. And I'm not sure that anybody would view me as a credible journalist ever again. My reputation will be ruined. No one will want to hire me. So I was fearing for my career, fearing for all the work that I had done, and uncertain of the future. So I was extremely anxious. I know I didn't sleep that night. And in that moment of anxiety and fear, I just thought, well, I don't know how to defend myself. And then the next morning, I went to do a show called Fox and Friends, and the people there were saying, "Hey, what happened? You got fired." And I realized the story was out everywhere. My cell phone was just erupting. Phone calls from every news organization, just constant. The phone finally just broke for so many calls. And I remember walking into the newsroom afterwards, and they have monitors there from every cable channel. And I kept seeing my face pop up, and I thought, what is going on? I haven't said a word about this, and yet this is big news. In fact, the next morning, subsequent to this, let me say, I came out of my hotel room, and there were stacks of newspapers there that are left for me, the New York Times, USA Today, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post. And when I opened the door, I saw right there on the cover of the New York Times was my face. And I thought, oh, my God, what did I do? Did I kill somebody? And I kicked it away. I thought, that's obnoxious. And there, right below it, was USA Today. And there again was my face. I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. And I pushed that away. And then I could see my name on the front of the Wall Street Journal. I thought, what is going on? This is the most amazing thing. And then subsequent to that, again, realizing this story had power well beyond anything that I had done, it really resonated with the American people. And that's the experience I've had with this book, that really my name may be on the book, but there's so many Americans who are frustrated with the poor quality of debate, discourse, discussion in the country that they feel, too, that they are part of this story. I'm reminded of a quote that comes from one of the founding fathers, George Washington, who said in 1783, addressing his officers, "If we are to be precluded from offering sentiments on matters which have alarming, even serious, deadly consequences, then reason is of no use to us, and what is it that we are fighting for?" And I think right now what I've taken away from all these events is that Americans feel that there is no use to reason if, in fact, everybody is shouting and everybody is being demeaned and marginalized and told to shut up. The idea that sticks with me is that there is no change, no progress. There can be, you know, as I'm speaking to you here in Philadelphia, there can be no Declaration of Independence, no Constitution, unless there is honest debate that allows good ideas to rise up, bad ideas to fall away. There can be no idea that leads us to understand the importance of a civil war to a civil rights movement. There can be no idea such as that allows women to gain the right to vote early in the 20th century and that creates a feminist movement late in the 20th century. That there has to be room for real ideas and real honest debate without people being called crazy and bleeding heart liberals and crazy right wingers, much less bigots and racists. But right now we are in a moment in American life where political correctness and speech codes are enforced all around us. And the middle, people in the middle, make the choice of saying, it's better that I bite my tongue, better that I not talk about this, rather than risk being ostracized, being labeled, being marginalized, told to shut up, or in my case, being fired. The enforcers in this environment tend to be political parties, so much so now that if you're on the right, oftentimes you're arguing with other people on the right about who is more conservative. Or if you're on the left, arguing about who is more pure in terms of their liberal beliefs. And if you are trying to speak to the center, again, you are viewed as crossing political lines, a traitor, not being a good brother, if you dare to cross racial lines to try to have meaningful conversation. This, to me, is all part of this corrosive impulse that is undermining the quality of debate in our country today. The examples abound. Well, back to being the host, what examples are you talking about? It seems to me, says the host, that there's lots of free talk in this country. People say all kinds of things. Have you turned on the radio recently? People say the most outrageous things on the talk shows. Turn on the comedians, the comedy shows. They say outrageous, rude, offensive things. So what are you talking about? And I would say, no, I think you have confused the fact that people are free to speak and say offensive, provocative things, the idea of free speech, with the idea of honest debate. Yes, people say crazy, offensive things all the time, but those things tend to be said in such a way as, again, to enforce the speech code. As to say, anybody who crosses the line is subject to be demonized, to be mocked, to be seen as insufficiently liberal or conservative. The Supreme Court has recently said, in fact, that free speech is to be affirmed under the First Amendment almost without any reservation. Recently, the Supreme Court ruled in terms of violent video games that even young children should be free to buy those games. The Supreme Court has said that the Westboro Baptist Church, engaging in those rants I was talking about earlier, should be free to say whatever they want, even if they're disturbing a funeral. And the Supreme Court has said that free speech, again, is the underlying principle of allowing people to make huge anonymous donations to political campaigns. So at this moment, free speech is not under attack in America. What's under attack in America is honest debate. Thank you very much. It's hard to have an honest debate because we as individuals know if I say that, someone could misinterpret it. Someone will say, do you know what he or she said? And suddenly I'm not a member of the club anymore. Suddenly I'm the outsider. Suddenly I am someone who is viewed as rude, obnoxious, having crazy thoughts. Suddenly my job may be at stake. I'll give you some examples. You asked about examples. I'm thinking about an example of a Democrat, Alan Grayson, down in Florida, who was running against an opponent, a Republican. And Grayson just took his opponent's words, out of context and began calling his opponent Taliban Dan. Just awful. You would think this is beyond the pale. But in a situation where people are now in a constant election cycle, the negative ads that we see in the campaigns, they extend into our ability to consider legislation and consider acts of governing. That's why you get into a situation where a congressman from South Carolina will stand up while President Obama is speaking, not stand up, but shout out, "You lie," with regard to what the president has to say. We get into a situation where a candidate like Sharon Angle in Nevada will talk about frustration with the government and suggest Second Amendment remedies. You get into a situation where legislators, Democrats in Wisconsin, frustrated at the actions of the governor, will simply flee the state rather than engage in debate. You get into a situation where John Kyle, a senator from Arizona, when asked about funding for Planned Parenthood, will say 90% of what Planned Parenthood does is abortion. And then when he's confronted with the fact that that's absolutely wrong, say, "Oh, I didn't mean it as a fact." Wow. I'm reminded of what Daniel Patrick Moynihan had to say about the idea that, yes, we can argue opinions, but we should not ever find ourselves in a position where we're arguing facts. And yet, in this environment, too often, people feel free to argue the facts or present the facts in a distorted manner, which is what Senator Kyle did in trying to change the terms of understanding of the role of Planned Parenthood in American society. To me, this is a troubling development, one that inhibits free-flowing debate in our country. Let me just say, as the host, that I would then turn to Juan and I would say, "Well, when did this start?" And I would say, you know, I go into this in the book. Some people might think this is a book about sour grapes or vindictiveness towards NPR, but to the contrary, only the first chapter really tells the story of what happened there. 90% of the book is about what's going on in this country and how hard it is to have an honest conversation, and goes back to the time when political correctness first started in the 60s and 70s in service to the idea of making language more neutral, serving the idea of gender equality, racial equality, speaking about people with disabilities as if they are fully human. And then you go through the various backlashes that people encounter, as on college campuses some object to having books, great books, because they're supposedly written by dead white men. And then you get into another phase where you get the evangelicals citing the Bible in the course of social political debates as their guiding principle. And then finally you find yourself in a situation in the course of arguments over, let's say, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, where an Ari Fleischer, the president's spokesman, will say everybody has to watch what they say. And suddenly you find that if you are questioning the president's war policies, you are cast as not being patriotic, and that you are told to question something like the extent of civil liberties incursions under the Patriot Act, that again, you're not really standing with us. You're either with us or against us. And now people understand that they can be punished for what they have to say. This is all part of a moment, it seems to me, where people are not under some criminal sanction that would suggest that free speech is under threat, but rather that we are censoring ourselves because we understand that there is social sanction to be paid for trying to engage in honest debate and honest discussion. "Well, Juan, give me some more examples. What are you talking about?" And I'd say, "Well, you know, let's talk about terrorism, which is the subject that got me in so much hot water. President Obama and his administration refused to use the term terrorism. They prefer to use the term, according to Homeland Security and Janet Napolitano, they use the phrase man-made disasters, not terrorism." Not terrorism, even though when Theo Van Gogh, the documentary maker, made a movie about how Muslim women are treated, he was killed. Not terrorism, even though, as I'm speaking to you here tonight in Philadelphia, there's a political cartoonist in Seattle, Molly Norris, who is under protection of the FBI and in hiding because she suggested that in the United States, the political cartoonist should be free to have a Draw Muhammad Day. She said, we as a nation are free to caricature anybody, including Jesus Christ and Muhammad, but the threats that came in against her life were so strong, so severe, that a year plus later, she remains in hiding. That we are a country that knows about Muslim extremism and terrorism because we have seen a journalist like Daniel Pearl have his head cut off, and again, jihad cited as the reason. And yet, people don't want to talk about the link between radical Islam and terrorism. It makes honest debate very, very difficult. Or why go to something so emotional and difficult? Why not just talk about what we've seen in Washington the last few days in terms of the budget debate? That's a great example. There you see people on the right saying, oh, no, absolutely no tax hikes. No tax hikes, even though they're being offered $3 and $4 to 1 in terms of spending cuts and entitlement cuts, and still saying no, and citing Ronald Reagan as an example of a man who stood on principle, although I must tell you, I covered Ronald Reagan's White House. I'm reminded of what Lloyd Benson said to Dan Quayle about, I knew John Kennedy. And you're no John Kennedy, because I knew Ronald Reagan, and I knew Ronald Reagan was a compromiser and a tax hiker in his time. And yet people today act as if, no, couldn't be. That's not the reality. That's just not true. You know, so the examples, it seemed to me, are all around us. I think of so many critical issues that go unsettled at this moment. Think about immigration reform. President Bush, at the start of his second term, saying he had political capital now and he wanted to deal with this issue. And Karl Rove, his top political lieutenant, saying, we want to create a permanent Republican majority by reaching out to the Hispanic community and settling this issue. And yet, in his recent book, President Bush wrote, there was so much of a populist backlash coming from right-wing talk radio that he couldn't do it. That the most powerful political actor on the American scene, the American president, in alliance with the Chamber of Commerce, the business community, could not act to deal with immigration because any time they tried to do it, they were accused of offering amnesty to criminals, inviting in terror babies. The language was so awful that they backed off and accepted defeat. Again, no honest debate in service to solving real problems that face our country. And it's not just immigration. Here in Philadelphia, you've been dealing with what people call these flash mobs. And I'm reminded of what Bill Cosby went through when he talked about bad, violent, dysfunctional behavior in the black community. And he was told, you know what, you're just giving sustenance to the far right wing, to the Rush Limbaughs of the world, you're airing dirty laundry. Cosby, who had contributed so much to the civil rights movement, and of course in terms of his career, everything from not just the Cosby Show, but for those of you who are old enough to remember I Spy, I mean this guy with an incredible, incredible career, and yet he is marginalized. They dig up dirt on his personal life, intending to embarrass and marginalize him because he dares to talk about the real issues inside the black community. And the reluctance to talk about what's going on here in Philadelphia with these mobs, to say these are young black kids, oftentimes poor kids, and they're attacking people, oftentimes whites, and they are damaging the community's reputation, hurting business downtown, again, indicates the difficulty in having honest conversation across racial lines in our country. I think about guns, how difficult it is to have a discussion about guns in the country without somebody saying, oh, you're just trying to take away my guns. And yet we see constantly, it's not even really any more big news, there's so many shootings, so many people killed on a constant basis in this country. And of course, you could have a conversation as well about the U.S. Senate, where now it takes 60 votes to get anything done because of the power of filibusters and obstructionists. 60 votes. At the moment, the Senate is where debate goes to die. And it used to be the greatest chamber for debate in the world. Again, an all an indication of how difficult it is to have an honest conversation in America today. So if I was the talk show host at this point, I'd say, Juan, let's take a break and let's take some calls from the listeners. Thank you very much for your call.
Hi. As the host of Juan Williams and Juan Williams, I'd like to point out that we have microphones. Please raise your hands. Wait for me to call on you. We'll get you a mic. I can tell already that we're going to have more questions than we have time for. So we'll get to as many of you as we can. One question, please. And please phrase your question as a question. The gentleman in the yellow right there.
You said you fear people in Muslim garb. However, I've never seen a terrorist act committed by anyone in Muslim garb. They might be extremist Muslims, but they never wear Muslim garb. I never actually saw any kind of terrorist act with anyone in any garb. I remember when Jewish...
Can you give it to us as a question? Because, like I said, there are a lot of people here at the
studio. Okay, so we like honest debate, but we're not having honest thought. An honest thought is that Al-Qaeda wants us bankrupt. That's our thought, but... The people in Muslim garb are not a problem. The people in Hasidic garb are not the problem when it comes to Jews. It has nothing to do with garb.
Sir, what's your question?
The garb, but I think you ought to, I won't say apologize, but think about the thought. When I was at 30th Street Station, a man with a suit and tie handed a suitcase to McDonald's behind the counter. I didn't want to screw on him, but I ran like hell. And wasn't a Muslim. That's what a terrorist act would be. If people were Muslim garb, I'd relax because I pay attention to what's going on. So you should not apologize for the thing, but you ought to second apologize for the thought because we're not having honest thinking.
Thank you, sir. Another question. Right there.
In view of what, should NPR continue to receive government funding?
You know, this is a question about NPR funding, and it came up right afterwards because, as I say, this thing steamrolled way out of my control, way beyond me, and then it became highly politicized. And the way that it was politicized was that conservatives in Congress said, you know, we always think of NPR as biased, and we now see this as an opportunity to make an issue of defunding NPR. And for fear of appearing vindictive or acting, again, out of sour grapes, I stayed away from the issue. But about 3 months later, there was, as this issue continued to percolate, there was a fundraising letter from Congressman Steve Israel of New York who said, you know what, we Democrats need to support NPR because NPR is the counter to what Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity are putting out. And to me, as a journalist, I thought, wait a minute. If that's the case, then when NPR journalists do anything contrary to what liberal orthodoxy or the Democratic Party might be interested in, then they're going to be subject to some kind of lack of support coming from Democrats, even charges that they're not doing a good job from Democrats. And I don't think that's the kind of conditions any good journalist would want to work under, that suddenly if you're angering the Republicans 1 minute, you're angering the Democrats, and they take turns in saying, we don't want to support NPR. I think NPR is a much-loved brand. I think advertisers would be dying to get a hold of a highly educated, affluent audience. And so I think it would be best to have NPR as an independent entity that would be supporting itself. And I think it could do it. But, you know, when I said that again, there were people who had great upset with me. and I was subject to be misinterpreted as just being Mr. Sour Grapes. But that's the way I feel about the issue. In fact, I'm reminded that NPR's officials said, you know, they only take in 1 or 2% of their funding anyway from the public till. So to me, given the budget constraints that we're under and all the rest, the sense of how would you prioritize thing, I think people love NPR. NPR would do fine, and it would be done with all of these political entanglements.
Another question. Gentleman in the orange and blue, or red and blue, sorry.
The core group on the right is the Tea Party. What is the core group on the Democratic side? What? Give us a little bit of this last year, how this all developed. Thank you.
Hold on, because I wasn't sure I understood the latter part of the question, how this all evolved.
I jumped from the Tea Party on the right and wanted to know on the left, how did the split develop in the last year? Who's driving the left?
I think that you could look at it in purely political terms and see where the money comes from, and the money, without a doubt, the money and the votes come from young people, minority groups, Hispanics, but almost uniformly blacks, women, again, younger women more so than older women, unions. Unions are a tremendous support group there. Someone here said the Jewish community. Again, Jewish community is largely Democrats. So all that contributes to the Democratic side of the aisle. But I think that when you talk about what's driving the right and talk about the kind of grassroots passion that we saw come out of the Tea Party, you know, you have to think about exactly where those grassroots have emerged from. I think they emerged largely from older white seniors upset about the Health Care Reform Act, seeing health care reform as government run amok, intrusive government, big government, likely leading to tax increases, possibly leading to cuts in terms of Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security. A huge dispute there that I think was evidenced in very heated town hall meetings that got tremendous media coverage and, again, helped the various fragments of the Tea Party then to really rise to power and then led to the huge victories by the Tea Party freshmen in the 2010 midterms. On the Democratic side, that kind of passion had not been seen since President Obama ran for office, and in large part it was passion that was born of an antipathy towards President Bush and his policies in terms of the wars, as well as his stewardship of the economy. So it was like an anti-Bush energizer that emerged as that kind of Democratic passion and power, Democratic grassroots, that you would say is the complement to the Tea Party. But in a more sophisticated level, I would say to you that what we're seeing at this moment in terms of American demographics is also dictating American politics. That if you stop and think about the Tea Party as made up of older, conservative, white Americans, you stop and think about who turned out in that 2010 race, and it's that group. They turned out in disproportionate numbers. Who turned out back in November of 2008? It was that younger, minority, union crowd, more female. They turned out, and that's the group that was so enthused about President Obama. And going towards 2012, again, it's a question of who turns out. If you've been watching as this 2012 presidential year is evolving, I hope you notice that the first ads run by both Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS group and the Obama campaign, as well as RNC and DNC, have been in Spanish. And it's because both groups see that if they can control the Hispanic vote right now, they can win in swing states like Colorado, North Carolina, New Mexico, states that are likely to determine the outcome of this upcoming contest.
A few more questions. A lady in the second row here. Peg, if you can give me the mic.
Why do you think there are so few African Americans and other minorities in a forum such as this? Because that's sort of a very standard kind of experience, that when there is an opportunity for discussion, that it isn't taken.
You mean like at this event tonight? Well, I think that you have to consider, you know, the whole library setting, the whole experience, who has education in our country, who reads books in our country. You know, if you were to actually count in terms of the demographics of the book reading audience, fewer young people read books now than older people. And if you were to talk about who's highly educated in our country, it's a huge racial divide. And the whole notion of spending an evening here as opposed to at the ball game or hanging out, I think that there is a racial divide. I don't think there's any question about it. It's very difficult to talk about it because, again, people could take offense, but I think I'm telling you the truth. But it seems like you have something else to say to me. Can you let her have the microphone back?
But you're an African-American political celebrity or notoriety, and one would think that that in itself would have the kind of draw. This is not just about reading books. You represent something within the African-American community where I don't understand that there's not more of a response and interest on the part of minorities and African-Americans to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what,
I'm saying something that's also very politically incorrect.
That's what I was about to say to you. I think that, you know, it's not like, you know, when you said African American celebrity, I think if you had Spike Lee here, right, I think he would be embraced as, you know, politically correct in terms of the orthodoxy within the black community. I will never be embraced in those terms. And secondly, I think I'm thrilled that you're here because you're interested in the larger topic and in the whole notion of honest discourse and debate in our society. And I think that should cross racial lines. But I'm never going to be Beyonce if you're talking about African-American celebrities. I would show you my legs, but I don't want to scare anybody off.
Lady third, 1, 2, 3, 4 rows on the left.
Hi, I kind of wanted to respond a little bit to that question.
Sure.
I'm a reader. I have a book. And I noticed that on riding on public transportation, people don't seem to read anymore. You do see a few people with Kindles, but for the most part, people don't read. I read the paper. I listen to talk radio all day. And to say quickly, I think people are scared to talk about politics. I think people are just scared in general. They don't know what to do. They don't know how to respond. And I think that a lot of people are waiting to be saved. They're waiting for maybe another Obama or something like that. That's what I really think.
Well, I think what you said is demonstrable. I know as someone who loves newspapers and, you know, been involved with newspapers most of my life, when I was a little boy, I just wanted to be a writer. I mean, my big dream was to have a byline in the New York Daily News. That's what I, you know, the idea that I would have a book in the Philadelphia Free Library was beyond my imagination, you know. But today, the experience that people in the newspaper industry have is that young people don't read the paper. We can, you know, in the newspaper business, they can have some fortune, some good luck occasionally with boys in terms of using the sports section as a hook to draw them in. But with young women specifically, there's almost no hope. Young women just don't read newspapers. And people, of course, get most of their news now from TV or from the internet, and in that environment, what they do is they tend to go to sites that they view as affirming their pre-existing opinions and attitudes, and they do the same thing, I think, on cable news. They go to strong personalities that tell them news from their perspective, and people, you said people are afraid. I was interested in hearing you say that because I think people are afraid to step out and think for themselves and speak for themselves in so many ways. They want to know what the message of the day is, and they want to stay on message for left, right, black, white, all the rest. I think it's become threatening to fear that somehow you are going to be called out, told you're wrong, told you're crazy for speaking your mind. And I think this is particularly pernicious in the black community. I really do. I think it's a real problem. And unfortunately, you know, in terms of the American media, it's very limited in terms of seeing the variety of opinions and the shape of opinion that can occur in the black community. There's most often, if there's something happening, the reporters all run to Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. That's just the way they, I mean, it's unbelievable to me. And by the way, you talk about a great example of censorship inside a community. When President Obama was candidate Obama, and he was simply talking about the out-of-wedlock birth rate in the black community and the need for black men to be better dads, you remember the response from Jesse Jackson, which was to say that he should be castrated, that he was talking down to black people. Again, that was an effort, I think, to marginalize President, then-candidate Obama, rather than dealing with the substance of what he was saying. But that's instructive that at that level of American life, it's hard to speak your mind. It's hard to speak truth.
A few more questions. I see a lot of hands. Gentlemen in the front row here.
I don't think the demographic of this audience has anything to do with race. I think it has to be age. We're all old here. I'm retired. I'm almost 70. And the reason I raised a family, I didn't have time to come out. I'd read, I'd listened, but I didn't have the time. I enjoyed you on TV, but I don't think it has too much to do about race here. It's age. We have the luxury of coming out and seeing you. But
and I think I'm offensive, and now all the women in here are going to mug you on the way out. You know what I mean? So thank you for being you. You know, you're making me look good here. I'm telling you.
Lady about halfway back in the white, and then we'll go to the lady in the black right there. Oh, Brittany. Go to Brittany. She's about 10 rows back. Right.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I enjoyed you. And not only am I black, I'm here, and I paid.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Wow. You're a threefer.
Hello. And I think that is a bit of a stereotype. I think if you go to certain places, you'll find black people who are interested. And I just want to say that I thought it was very unfair that you were fired. I thought it was overreaction. And I'm a liberal Democrat, by the way. And I just thought it was unfair. And I think you go out of your way to be fair. I've watched you on Fox. And and I think you do a great job. I don't know how you deal with it all, but, you know, I appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
I guess I'll speak on behalf of the younger generation today.
I'm going to have to protect this man. I got your back. I got you, man. Go right ahead.
I just want to thank you for your important message. And we talked a lot about the problem tonight, about political correctness, and I wondered if you had anything to say about potential solutions, such as where higher education could come into play or public forums like the library?
Well, as I said at the very start, as a fan of libraries, I think libraries open doors, and part of opening doors is seeing the experience of other people. And one of the dangers that occurs to me in this current media environment is that we don't really hear about people who have different lives, different experiences, different point of views from those of our own or those of our friends or those of people who are of like mind. Because if you're going to the internet and you're going to a specific site or if you're listening to one talk radio show or you're going to a certain kind of movie, you know what? It just becomes your crowd, your way of living, your way of thinking. It just becomes you. You know, in this environment, conservatives say to me, oh, you know, that New York Times editorial page, they're so liberal. That Jon Stewart, he's so liberal. Hollywood, they're so liberal in Hollywood. And then the liberals are saying, that Wall Street Journal editorial page, they're so conservative. Talk radio is so conservative. The Drudge Report, Fox News, they're so conservative. And you realize they've all got their devils and their demons out there, and oftentimes they don't even listen or watch or read the other side. They just assume they've got a stick man out there. But what really, on some levels, okay, but what really worries me is if you're a poor kid living in Philadelphia and you're a rich man living on the main line, how often do you know about each other's lives? How often do you know about your struggles, your desires, your ambitions? on either side. And too often, because of the way media operates today, those two have no sense of each other. There is no common ground. And in terms of real conversation, or for those two to be face-to-face and have an honest debate, it becomes highly difficult because they're not even talking about the same news stories. They're not talking about the same realities. It's like they're from two different planets, although they may live 10 miles apart. But that's where we are. And to me, that is a huge problem for us. And so when you ask me about solutions, I'm thinking about making an effort on the part of media consumers to be aggressive consumers, to go elsewhere, to get outside of your box. Secondly, in terms of the politics, to not play into the politics that is so prevalent now, where the big money flows to people who say the most extreme things. I cited the example of Joe Wilson screaming out, "You lie," at President Obama. Joe Wilson immediately became a fundraising sensation in the aftermath of that, because people who were so angry at the president and the health care reform just filled up his campaign chest. That is not the case for someone like Gabby Giffords, who appeared yesterday in Congress to much celebration, but the fact is that she is someone who stood against the tide of anti-immigrant legislation in Arizona and who was standing against even some of the arguments about, you know, look, we need more assault weapons in this country. And so before she was shot, she said, you know, to be a politician who's trying to be reasonable and trying to deal with both sides, there's no financial or political reward, none for being in the middle. None for trying to work in the spirit of I'm trying to do best for America and I love my country. No reward whatsoever. The big reward goes to people on the far left and people on the far right and people who are inflexible. And I think at some point all of us have a role to play in terms of resisting this. I'll tell you one more thing on this point, that the most effective tool in terms of political campaigning in America is a negative ad. If I say something negative about you, people will remember it far more than if I say something nice to you or say I simply have an intellectual disagreement with you. If I in any way am able to point out some character flaw, you've been divorced 3 times, whatever, people will remember that for days. And so negative campaigning and attack ads and negative research have become mother's milk in politics. And I think it's now affected every part of our life and affected the ability to feel comfortable in taking a stand, because you know right away you're going to be personally attacked. It's going to be an ad hominem assault on you for whatever you say. I think it dissuades good people from running for office, and I think it dissuades good people from engaging in honest debate.
You know, I see a lot of hands, but we are out of time, and I just want to ask Mr. Williams to take us out on an optimistic note, actually. It can't be all that bad.
No, I don't think it's all that bad, because I think, you know what? For me, the experience of this book, as I said, Andy, is way beyond me. I'm just finding that people are saying, I'm sick and tired of it. They're not going to tell me to shut up. I'm going to have an honest debate. I'm willing to say what's on my mind, and I'm glad somebody is saying, and this has been affirmed by all of you very kind people here tonight, that there's no reason for us to not be willing to speak out what's obvious to us about any political situation, any policy debate. I think that the American people are ready now to change the tide of running to the extremes and say, you know what? I'm trying to get back to the middle, and I'm trying to do what's right for America. I think that's a very optimistic, positive note. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.